Welcome to the show. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy tonight on Nova M Radio. Phone number is 800-989-1480. Bubble Boy was out there giving a presser today. Mission accomplished, I think. Seems the entire media paid attention to that, as opposed to the fact that Harriet Myers, George Bush's former counsel, basically was in contempt of Congress today. It's a pleasure to be here for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. My buddy Lauren's here. Lauren, you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone.
Yeah, all right. You're going to speak in the microphone when you do that next time. So George Bush gave a press conference today to argue that things are going really well in Iraq. Things are going fantastic. We got on the run. We're going to win. And we just need to not be so defeatocratic with everything. I got to say, I'm not going to play much clips from his presser today because, of course, it was all just a bunch of bullcrap. There were a couple of astonishing comments, I thought. He did get one question on the Libby decision. But, of course, as far as I could tell, Lauren, I didn't watch the whole thing because at one point I just started getting nauseous. But did anybody ask about Harriet Myers? I mean, while he was up there during his press conference, Harriet Myers' seat in the House Judiciary Committee hearing, trying to get to the bottom of this corruption of the Department of Justice, was empty. She apparently decided that Congress simply can't subpoena anybody. You don't have to show up when Congress subpoenas you. And so did Bush get a single question about Harriet Myers during that press conference?
No.
All right, kudos to the corporate media. They fell for that one, hook, line, and sinker. Here's George Bush. This may be the only clip I play tonight of Bush. It really might be. He also basically blew off the Libby thing. But let's play this. This is number seven.
We're at the beginning stages of a great ideological conflict between those who yearn for peace and
4 years,
those who want their children to grow up in a normal, decent society, and radicals and extremists who want to impose their dark vision on people throughout the world. Iraq is obviously, Helen has got the attention of the American people, as it should. This is a difficult war, and it's a tough war.
It's tough and difficult.
As I have consistently stated throughout this presidency, it is a necessary war to secure our peace. I find it interesting that as this young democracy has taken hold, radicals and extremists kill innocent people to stop its advance.
It's
and that
interesting.
Ought to be a clear signal to the American people that these are dangerous people. And their ambition is not just contained to Iraq. Their ambition is to continue to hurt the American people.
Wow, this guy is totally off his rocker now. I find it interesting that people get blown up with bombs in Iraq.
I've been doing some learning.
I don't want to get all philosophical side of the sides of you, but I find it interesting that they're getting blown up. Just unbelievable. He again repeated the claim that the people who we are supposedly fighting in Iraq are the same people who attacked this country on 9/11, which is simply a joke. Apparently, you know, Tony Snow was on just about every single show. I'm not even going to play a single clip because I know if you caught anything of what he said, the one thing he said, you know, we're making progress. We're making progress. And there's all sorts of different sides. Just the mentality of the people in Iraq has changed. They have more confidence now that the surge is there. This despite the fact that civilian deaths have gone through the roof. U.S. military deaths are as high as they've been at any period since the beginning of this occupation. But somehow, Tony Snow, he can read collectively the minds of the Iraqi people who are just, they're just loving it over there now. That's actually probably a good, there's probably a lot of people going to be spending Labor Day weekend. Probably going to want to head to Iraq. The spirits are just so high there, Lauren.
And amidst all this, he also had time to get his teeth whitened, I think.
Tony Snow did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, good for him. And the guy's been ill, and so he gets his teeth whitened. He's been on every show today. And, of course, the only reason why they had this presser today was so that nobody would cover what went on in the House Judiciary Committee hearing. When we come back, we're going to talk to Christy Harden Smith. She's a blogger at FiredDogLake.com. And we're going to talk about the implications of Harriet Myers not showing up. This coming on the heels of Sarah Taylor, who's the White House political director. Harriet Myers, of course, was George Bush's White House counsel, who he tried to appoint to the Supreme Court. It didn't work out so well.
I remember that.
Yeah. And now she's saying, Congress can't, I'm above the ability of the U.S. Congress to call me to testify. There's all sorts of implications of this, and the real question is going to be, are the Democrats, are they going to show some cojones here? We'll be right back. We'll take some calls a little bit later. 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Number's 800-989-1480. On the phone, Christy Harden Smith from FiredogLake.com to talk to us about what happened today in the House Judiciary Committee hearing, or didn't happen today, Christy.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Now, today, Harriet Myers was a no-show.
That's correct. She was under subpoena, and she decided to just not show up for it. Because, you know, if any of us would have done that, nobody would have done anything to us. Isn't that how it works in the real world, Sam?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, that's what life is like, apparently. If you have been knighted by King George, apparently you don't have to, none of the laws of this country are in any way, are you bound by? One wonders if she can actually defy gravity, too, at this point. But let me ask you this. Now, all right, Christy, let's start with this. The Justice Department put out a memo, apparently, stating that essentially most senior Bush administration officials do not have to recognize congressional subpoenas. Is this unprecedented?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, the Department of Justice memo that they put out on that cited absolutely no legal precedent for that. They just pulled it out of thin air.
I mean, this is bizarre. I mean, it's, you know, let's make a distinction here. There are times where people will show up in front of Congress, like Sarah Taylor did, I guess, the other day. And she, of course, the political director from the White House, and claim there are certain things that she can't speak about because of executive privilege, or they take the Fifth, or whatever it is. But, I mean, do you remember a time where somebody just refused blanketly to show up?
No, and they should not be allowed to get away with that. You know, in any courtroom in America, if someone is under subpoena and they fail to show up, what the judge will do, whether it's a federal judge or whether it's some state court judge or whether it's the traffic court judge, if you don't show up for court, you know, they issue a subpoena and they haul your butt into court forthwith and throw you in jail if you don't show up. You know, there's no question. If you're just a regular American, you don't get some break like that. So, you know, not showing up for a congressional subpoena is not some small thing.
All right. And it's not clear yet that she's going to get away with this. Today, the subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee basically validated, I guess they didn't issue a contempt charges, but they basically cleared the way for contempt charges today. Is that right?
That's right. They set the stage for that. There is a certain procedure that has to be followed in order to have a contempt citation be issued. And my understanding is this is the first step along that road in the procedure. I'm hoping that they're going to consider doing an inherent contempt citation, which is something that the president can't just nullify outright, but they have to respond to. So my hope is that that's something that they're going to pursue. And there's been some writing on that. CAGRO X did some great work on that in a couple of articles on the Next Hurrah. and on Daily Coast in the last couple of days that folks should take a look at. And Josh Marshall had some information on that as well on Talking Points memo today.
Yeah, there's a couple issues. Now, first, one procedure they can actually ask the essentially the Department of Justice to issue a contempt or to go into a court and pursue contempt charges. But that's looking less likely that that could possibly happen because the Department of Justice has sort of preemptively said, you know, we don't believe in the Constitution. We're not going to cite any precedent, but we're not going to raise this in the court. So under inherent contempt powers, essentially the Congress says to their sergeant at arms, go arrest this person.
Yes.
And then then what happens? They bring them into Congress and they just basically start the trial.
Well, they can actually issue their own court documents without having to rely on the Department of Justice to do that. That's my understanding. It's something that hasn't been used since, I think the last time was back in the Teapot Dome scandal. So it's been a while since they've had to do that. But because the Department of Justice back then was implicated in the problems, just as the Department of Justice and Alberto Gonzalez today are implicated in, you know, the issue of the U.S. attorney firings. There's a lot of analogous behavior that I think, you know, can be argued in this on Congress's end of things.
Now, how likely do you think this is that they're going to do this? I mean, and what are the implications if they don't do it?
Well, I mean, the implications if they don't do it are enormous. You know, there have been huge challenges the last few years anyway in terms of the separation of powers. Dick Cheney's theory of the unitary executive, which, you know, I think is more accurately described as the unilateral executive, is that all of the power of government, you know, essentially is consolidated in the presidency, and that Congress is just there, and we heard this from President Bush actually in his press conference today, that Congress is there to pass budgets to fund his priorities. That, in their mind, is the purpose of Congress, but that is not what the intent was in terms of the framers. You know, there's supposed to be a balance and a push and a tug between the two branches, and, you know, Congress has to enforce this subpoena. If they don't, then they might as well just stop getting their paychecks.
You know, there's a real sense. I mean, I was just shocked today about how little coverage the fact that Harriet Myers did not show up today got. And I think that was, frankly, the reason why Bush had his press conference today, was to keep that off being the front page story. But, I mean, this has massive implications, because if they don't pursue this, essentially Congress's ability to provide oversight is completely wiped away. I mean, we're at the stage here where this is a major constitutional crisis, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but in the past, once you get down to this point where they start to clear the way for contempt proceedings, that's when the two parties get together and start to negotiate. But this memo from the Department of Justice suggests that they're not going to do, they're playing an entirely different game here.
Well, and I think, you know, the thing that is odd with this is, you know, when you look at all of the court precedents, and I thought that Linda Sanchez laid that out really well today in the hearing, in the subcommittee hearing for the House Judiciary, all of the various precedents, a lot of which came up during the Clinton administration, because the Republicans who controlled Congress, especially Dan Burton in the House, who's on the Judiciary Committee, Chris Cannon, who was very, you know, vocal today on the Judiciary Committee, you know, a lot of the folks who were there, they're the ones who pushed this issue with the Clinton administration, with Mike Espy's investigation, with any number of things that came up with Janet Reno. They pushed these precedents out into the open. They pushed the envelope in terms of no protection for White House counsel, you know, very little protection for members of the Justice Department who may have advised the president. So the precedents are on the books, pushed by Republicans, so that executive privilege does not, you know, go over as a blanket privilege. And now they're trying to turn around very hypocritically and say that, well, it was good enough for Clinton, but it doesn't apply to George Bush.
Now, I know you were live blogging the hearing today. What mm-hmm. was there anything that the Republicans were saying that sort of surprised you? I mean, I know Chris Cannon is out there trying to say there's nothing about this, but how can he at that point, you know, it's one thing to say there's no scandal here. It's another thing to say that it's perfectly legitimate for Harriet Myers simply to ignore a subpoena.
You know, the frightening thing was that Chris Canham was actually making some sense today in terms of talking about the precedents, you know, when he wasn't doing his very loud Chris Canham act and was really getting down to the nitty-gritty of the legal aspects. He was right in terms of the two-prong test that the SB case and the Nixon case put out in terms of enforcement of a subpoena for a contempt citation. You have to have not only the information that what you're seeking can only be obtained from that particular White House source and that it's also relevant to an ongoing investigation, but you also have to show that there's an underlying either criminal or some other malfeasance that's taken place that the Congress is investigating that has substance. And it's the second prong of that that Canham was arguing that they don't necessarily have the information on. But the reason they don't have that, you know, information solidly, if indeed they don't have it, which I would argue they do, but if they don't have it, the reason they don't is because the White House has been stonewalling them, like Nixon did with the tapes, and refusing to turn over that evidence. And when you look at the precedents from the Nixon years, from the Watergate investigation, the court clearly said, look, the president cannot hide the ball and just pretend that this evidence doesn't exist. He can't cover his own rear end, basically, because you don't allow criminals to do that. Why would you allow the President of the United States to do that?
All right, Christy Harden Smith over FiredogLake.com. You guys are doing great reporting on this and great commentary. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk more about this, and we'll take your calls. 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy.
And deeply concerned that former White House counsel Harriet Myers has apparently chosen to forego this opportunity to give her account of the firing of the U.S. attorneys and the potential politicization of the U.S. Department of Justice. Through extensive interviews and review of documents, it appears clear that Ms. Myers played a significant role in the Bush administration's decision to fire at least 9 U.S. attorneys.
Linda Sanchez, Democrat from California, speaking to an empty chair. I got to be honest with you. Had Harriet Myers actually been there, I'm not sure that really there would have been a big difference. She is not exactly the brightest bulb, but apparently she's willing to go to the mat for George Bush. There was a head of an EPA under the Reagan administration. What was her name? Gorsuch. And Gorsuch, I believe. And they were basically pulling the same thing with her, although I think she actually showed up. And the Reagan administration, the Justice Department at that time, funded her defense. About 3 or 4 months down the road, they basically ran out the clock, and then they just threw her to the wolves. And I don't know if they'll do the same thing with Harriet Myers. But I mean, clearly they're just buying time here. And it remains to be seen whether the House Judiciary Committee is going to do anything about it. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on NOVAM Radio, 800-989-1480. There's a couple of different theories out there because it is rare, like we were saying with Christy Harden Smith, it's rare it ever gets to this point. And there's a couple of different theories out there as to what the Democrats in the House, because, of course, the Republicans aren't going to do squat. I mean, they still are. I mean, this is basically the game plan. Just keep. I mean, this is what I go through with my kid. She's 2 years old, and it's just relentless. The same time they just keep repeating the same thing over and over again. Want raisins? Want raisins? Want raisins? There are no raisins. Want raisins? Want raisins? Want raisins? There are no raisins, sweetheart. Raisins? Raisins? It just happens to be raisins in this case, as opposed to. Being blind to the Bush administration, essentially, they're now wreaking havoc on our system of government. which is essentially the extension of conservative ideology. But Martin Lederman, who blogs over, I think, at Balkanization, and he is a law professor, I think, at Georgetown. He has written a couple of potential scenarios that Congress can follow. One is the one that Patrick Leahy was talking about on the Sunday shows. He was suggesting if Sarah Taylor, or Harriet Myers, I guess, just in the generic sense, doesn't show up, they would issue a contempt of Congress order and expect the Department of Justice to pick it up. When he was asked, do you think the Department of Justice will do it? He said, I would be amazed if they didn't. Well, they sent out this memo. I mean, they're sending all indications that they will not respect a contempt order from Congress. There are other options. Christy Harden Smith touched on it. It is this notion of inherent contempt, where essentially Congress just takes over the whole ballgame. And they take the sergeant at arms of the Senate or the House, and they personally arrest officials and detain them in the Capitol jail or guardhouse.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting.
Now, I don't know if there is a Capitol jail. I mean, because this hasn't been invoked in a long time.
Can't you just picture, like, somebody throwing on an orange sash, like a crossing guard uniform, just like, okay, we're going. We're going to go get them.
Well, the question is, where they, you know, where would they hold Harriet Myers? In somebody's office, I guess, and just face the corner. And then, according to Martin Lederman, this person would then be tried by the legislative house and, if found guilty of civil contempt, would be detained until compliance with the subpoena or until the session of Congress ends. I don't know if they would send her to a jail or what, and he said this authority has not been invoked since 1935. He suggests there's a third option, which he perceives as most likely, that Congress would file a civil action in federal court seeking declaratory relief or an injunction requiring the enforcement of its subpoena. Basically, you know, when Department of Justice says that you don't have to follow this, they're just, that's their opinion, and would actually go to court and sort of do an end run around the Department of Justice and see if they can hold it. And then there's a third version where they could actually appoint a special prosecutor. But I don't know if there's a law, actually a statute, that allows for that at this point. But it's really getting ridiculous now. There's another story out about Alberto Gonzalez's, I don't know, this is third or fourth explicit proven lie that he has told to the Senate. This is from the Washington Post. This is on Tuesday, but the Department of Justice came out today, I guess, with an explanation, a so-called explanation. 2 years ago, when the torture czar, Alberto Gonzalez, was testifying about the USA Patriot Act, he assured lawmakers that the FBI had not abused its potent new terrorism-fighting powers. This is the issuance of national security letters, which is basically this stopgap measure, almost like a circuit breaker, where they can just send letters to people, whether it's an institution, whether it's, you know, a telecommunications company or a library, and say, we want all the records of this other person, and you can't tell anybody that we've even asked for this. You can't tell anybody. And at that time, Gonzalez said there has not been one verified case of civil liberties abuses, Gonzalez told senators. This is on April 27, 2005. 6 days earlier, the FBI sent Gonzalez a copy of a report that said its agents had obtained personal information that they were not entitled to have. It turned out there were something like thousands of these violations. It was one of at least a half a dozen reports of legal or procedural violations that Gonzalez had received in the 3 months before he made his statement to the Senate. And this is according to FBI documents released under the Freedom of Information Act. This is the chief law enforcement officer of the entire country.
So what is he going to say now? Is he going to say, like, it hangs on the word verified, or it hangs on the word abuse, depends on...
Lauren, I know you're joking, and if I had my 360 here, I would be hitting trumpets right now, because you're absolutely right. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but it's absolutely right. The Washington Post reports that the DOJ, Department of Justice officials, said that Gonzalez's testimony isn't a lie because the violations he'd been informed of didn't qualify as abuse.
You know, at what point, when can we get to a point where the English language means something, where everyone knows what words mean?
Well, I mean, everybody does know. You can go to the dictionary and that the use of intent in abuse is completely, it's obsolete.
you'd think.
It's practically Old English at that point. Leonard from Glendale, KPHX. Welcome to the Mike Malloy Show. Sam Cedar filling in.
Hello. Thanks for letting me on the air.
Well, thank you for calling, Leonard.
Well, you know, on the front page, even though it's owned by Gannett, USA Today did put out, you know, the article on the very first page saying Iraqi police-assisted gunmen. And not to get off your subject, because I want to stay on yours, it's I hold these Army officials who kept that report under wraps for the last 7 months. They're basically the Iraqi police that my fellow soldiers, we have to unfortunately keep an eye on in the back of our heads. When we're out going to those Iraqi police stations, they assisted in the murder of American soldiers who didn't just die quickly, mind you. They were tortured. And, you know, you got McCain and Graham and all of the Republicans, except for, two or three that voted against bringing our soldiers home in April. Good on the Democrats. Finally, it's great what you did. But all of my Republican friends out there, Your Republican leaders today voted to continue the slaughter of my fellow American soldiers in Iraq for a corrupt theocratic government, okay? So you can thank them for all of the blood that's on their hands. I'm furious with them. And as far as the inherent contempt warrant, if they do not issue that and they want to go again through the courts – over the next week or two, we all know this is going to end up in the Supreme Court, really, and we know what's going to happen.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, Leonard, that the last time it got to this, and that story about Ann Gorsuch, it was Fred Fielding, who was the White House counsel at that time, who came up with this strategy of playing out the clock, and he developed that strategy with the help of John Roberts.
Exactly.
Who's John Roberts? Now, remind me again who John Roberts is, Leonard.
Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Yes,
exactly. And here's the thing, Sam. The thing is, our constitutional government, if the Democrats do not get this inherent contempt and they go the regular court route and drag this thing out and it just goes to the Supreme Court, our constitutional government, for all intents and purposes, if there was any doubt, is now not functioning, and I do hold responsible key leaders, whatever party they're in, for bringing the downfall of our government. Let me leave you with this. Lindsey Graham, let me say this right now. He had his colonel rank pinned on him personally by President Bush. He was out yesterday attacking Democrats for running to give my soldiers, my fellow soldiers, the rest that they deserve in between the going over there, and he voted again to not bring them back. Here is a man, a staff judge advocate, who gets up there and acts like he goes to the front every day. I deeply resent him. How dare you? Lindsey Graham, who in the heck are you to condemn my fellow soldiers to 15-month tours, okay? You are a hypocrite, sir, you and your friend John McCain and John Kyle. All of you need to send your children to Iraq, and don't give me about Senator McCain's boys being on the front. They're up, you know what, General Petraeus' rear end, because you know they're not out on the front like my fellow soldiers getting murdered today by members of the Iraqi government who say it's just fine for them to kill my fellow American soldiers.
Right,
that's what you Republicans are doing. And the Democrats, good on you. Good on you for finally standing up and getting going up here. Thank you.
All right, Leonard, I appreciate the phone call. You know, I got to say, his anger is completely justified. Lindsey Graham, you know, sitting there, first of all, a former JAG, I guess he's an active duty JAG, and was one of the main proponents of the Military Commissions Act, which, of course, is basically just one more attempt to whack at the Geneva Conventions. We got to take a break. 800-989-1480. I'll get back to the calls. We're going to talk a little bit more about this this constitutional crisis. But Leonard's absolutely right. The Democrats have to make a stand here. And this is not this transcends any type of notion of partisan politics at this point. The Bush administration has decided to play chicken with the Constitution, essentially. We're playing a game of chicken here, and if the Democrats blink, you're setting a precedent that, no, and I don't care if it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or any other Democrats in the future, you're setting a precedent here where you cannot hold the executive branch accountable for anything. It will destroy the entire fabric, the system of our government. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Streaming at NovaMRadio.com. The number is 800-989-1480. In the next hour, we're going to be talking to former federal prosecutor and author of United States v. George W. Bush, Elizabeth de la Vega. And apparently they're making her book into a movie. We're going to be talking to Robert Boris, writer and director of the film adaptation. Hopefully, my hope is it will be concurrent with an actual impeachment case. I'm not holding my breath, but I don't know. 45% of the American population is there already. And what I made a prediction, didn't I, Lauren? Remind me of that prediction.
Oh, gosh. Which one?
January 18th of 08. 68.5% of the American public will, you know,
support impeachment, right?
Support impeachment. I don't know if you're going to see it even at that point, but I think what you will see is it'll be a wake-up call to the American public just to see how out of touch Washington is with the American public.
Might not take that long.
Well, I didn't bet any money on it, so I wouldn't be upset if it actually showed up earlier than that.
Okay, so it's just be like a pride thing.
Yeah, exactly. Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo. Apparently, one of his knowledgeable emailers says it's a felony for the White House to prevent Harriet Myers from testifying under subpoena from the Congress. 18 U.S.C. Section 1505, whoever corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes the due and proper exercise of the power of inquiry under which any inquiry or investigation is being had by either House or any committee of either House or any joint committee of the Congress, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 5 years, or both. I'd vote for both, but I'm not, you know, the fine's not really going to mean much to them. And 18 U.S.C. Section 1515B, for those of you keeping score at home, as used in Section 1505, the term corruptly means acting with improper purpose. So it doesn't necessarily, it basically means if you're withholding Harriet Myers from testifying because you know she's got things to say, that, it seems to be, would be improper purpose. John in Lewisburg, welcome to the program, John. John, are you there? Line three. John.
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I get to follow up your last caller because this lady, Myers, Harriet, along with Karen Hughes, kind of enabled the cowardice of George Bush by going into the Texas National Guard Department before he became governor of Texas and wiped clean his military records.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's been with him for a long time. I got to let you go because your phone's not doing too well. Yeah, but she's been with him for a long time. Didn't she say, wasn't there something that came out when she was nominated for the Supreme Court? George Bush is the most intelligent man I've ever been around.
Well, she's definitely a fan.
Yeah. Wasn't there some question? I mean, he has a weird relationship with some of these women in his life.
Yes.
Karen Hughes. Harriet Myers. Very strange stuff.
Condi.
Yeah. I would submit that she's not been around very many intelligent people. Let's go to Ethan in Portland, line four. How you doing, Ethan? Ethan, are you there?
Yeah.
Welcome to the program, buddy.
Hey, Sam. It's nice to be able to hear you more than just once a week.
Well, it's nice to be able to hear you more than once a week.
Although I haven't been able to get call because my Peace March is at the same time as your Sunday show. So,
well, I understand, buddy. But that's as good a reason as any to miss the show.
Yeah. With the contempt of Congress, couldn't we call, couldn't Congress subpoena Dick Cheney and George Bush, and if they don't show up, then couldn't we hold them in contempt of Congress?
I mean, I guess theoretically, I think that you'd be hard-pressed to argue that executive privilege wouldn't work there, and there's slightly different, I guess, traditions and when it comes to the president and the vice president. But, I think, Ethan, what we're seeing now, it is beyond the concept of law at this point. We're seeing just pure power going head-to-head here. This is why the Democrats have to stand up now, because it is coming at the expense of our laws.
People are listening to Richard Nixon these quotes like, if the president does it, then that means it's not illegal. And they're thinking, wow, this is actually true, and we can get away with whatever we want.
This is what the Bush administration is trying to establish. I mean, this is exactly what they're trying to establish, and this is why it's so important that Congress use every tool they have at their disposal to stop this, to set a precedent here. I mean, because what you have on one hand, and this is the problem, Ethan, that Democrats have had for a long time, and I think this is a problem that the corporate media doesn't understand, and I think, frankly, a large part of the American population, I'm not talking about the 28% or wingnutters, I'm talking about those people out there who are considered low knowledge voters or whatever it is. They don't seem to understand at this point that the Republicans are not playing the same game. They have decided there are no rules. That simply if they can do it, it's right. And if they can get away with it, it's legal. They don't even recognize this concept of legality. Because to them, law is simply quaint. And it's time the Democrats, man, they got to stand up. Because now it's not just a question of them standing up from a political and a partisan standpoint. This is, we are headed towards a constitutional crisis. And the Democrats have to choose which side they're going to be on. The side of the Constitution or complete anarchy. We'll be right back. We'll take more calls. 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. Hello, Truth Seekers. Nova M Radio, 800-989-1480. Pleasure to be here tonight. On a day where George Bush, Bubble Boy, came out and gave his presser. Things are going good in Iraq. Wait, do we have that? Do we have that clip? George Bush, apparently, he's figured it all out. What the problem is with the war? You know, he's using psychology now. Watch out. Let's play this clip, Ian. You got it? Here it comes. This is Bush. He's just asked, why does the American people want this war to end?
First, I understand why the American people...
Why are you so resistant to that idea?
You know,
how much longer are you willing to give the surge to work before considering a change in this policy?
War fatigue in America. It's affecting our
psychology. First, I understand why the American people...
I understand that. It's an ugly war.
You know, they're tired of
it's
the
a war.
War
in which an enemy will kill innocent men, women, and children in order to achieve a political objective.
All right, wait a second. We've got to play that again, because here you got George Bush out there. He's explaining to the press here I mean, of course the man is talking to us like we're little children, because that's the way he is used to communicating. All right, so let's start this again, because you got to hear this. And I promise you, this will be maybe the second or last version of this. All right, let's play it now.
First, I understand why the American people are, you know, they're tired of the war. There's war fatigue in America. It's affecting our psychology. I've said this before. I understand that. It's an ugly war. It's a war in which an enemy will kill innocent men, women, and children in order to achieve a political objective. It doesn't surprise me that there is deep concern amongst our people.
This is a special war, folks. This is one where innocent people will die because of a trying to achieve something politically. See? It's because I take psychology. And that's why I know that there's war fatigue. That's what I learned, is that people are tired of it. And I know that. It's hard. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. They throw this guy out there basically just so you don't pay attention to what's really going on with the Harriet Myers thing. The Congress today, incidentally, basically later in the day, they responded quite well, as far as I'm concerned, to George Bush's presser today. Democrats were able to pass legislation in the House. Now, this isn't going to... I'm not... Don't delude yourself, folks. This isn't going to go anywhere. We're going to see series of these votes now. But, you know, bless the Democrats in the House. 219 Democrats, 4 Republicans voted in favor of requiring combat troops to begin to withdraw within 120 days to be completed by April 1st, 2008. I don't know how this is going to do in the Senate. But, you know, the Democrats in the House are leading the way. Hopefully the Senate will follow. Of course, George Bush at that point, I guess he would attempt to veto it. I mean, it's not going to, I don't think it's going to pass in the Senate, quite frankly. And because of all the talk that you hear from guys like Voinovich and Pajama Pete Domenici and Lugar, they don't care. I mean, they're just concerned about how the Republicans are going to do in the next election. That's it. They don't give one, they don't give us a crap whatsoever. They really don't. They can talk all they want, but they're not doing anything about it. This is basically the second coming of the Iraq study group coming 9 months later. When at this point we should have been out, according to the Iraq study group.
But Sam, passing a vote like this in the House, even if it doesn't go anywhere, shouldn't we still be happy about
that? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it's not a waste of time.
Right? No, of course it's not a waste of time. Of course it's not a waste of time. It's amazing that they were able to get that passed because the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, have been obstructing just about every single thing the Democrats are trying to do. In the House, they've taken more votes there. They've taken more votes in the House. They passed more legislation that hasn't ultimately gone through both houses, because apparently the Republicans are stopping. And this is, you know, this is one of the failures of the Democratic Party right now. The Republicans in the Senate are preventing the Democrats in the Senate from going to conference by filibustering these things. And the Democrat, I mean, have you heard how many times did we hear over the past 6 years when the Republican controlled House and Senate were ramming through bills like that prescription D plan, bill after bill after bill? They would ram them through both the houses. They'd get into conference. They would write up all sorts of new things. And they were still complaining about the Democrats being obstructionists. No up or down vote. The Republicans have filibustered time and time again. And the Democrats have basically just, they got together before with the Republicans. And they're still playing this, they're playing an incorrect game here. They do not understand what's happening. They get together with the Republicans and for the sake of Senate comedy, I guess I mean it both ways, C-O-M-I-T-Y, and the comedy, ha-ha. They say, all right, we won't force you to vote, to refuse to close debate. We'll just assume it won't happen, and that's when we'll go out and we'll say we needed 60 votes. What they should be doing is every time the Republicans obstruct, make them filibuster. Make them do it over and over and over again. Congressional Quarterly reports, federal lawmakers have held more votes on legislation and other matters in the first 6 months of this year than they did during the entire 2006 of the Republican-controlled 109th Congress. So they're moving at a pace twice as fast. And that's that was when the GOP leaders decided to defer action on the 110th Congress, now controlled by Democrats, on most of the 2006 spending measures. The House has held 600 roll call votes and 6 quorum calls this year, which puts the chamber well on its way to surpassing 867 votes and 18 quorum calls Republicans held in 95 after they assumed control of the House for the first time in 40 years. So this notion that the Democrats aren't doing anything, that they're wasting time with these investigations, is bull. It's bull. And I don't know how come I can read this Congressional Quarterly, but Chris Matthews can't. Maybe because he's got his face too far up Rudy Giuliani's backside. I don't know. Maybe he's trying to check on his prostate cancer, which I guess you could commend Matthews for doing. At least he's making the effort. One more point on this theme of the... you have to understand here, the conservative ideology has a total disregard for law. You know, it's very easy to forget that there is that this corruption is rooted in an ideology. When you have an entire political philosophy that is rooted in the concept that government is bad, that government is an obstacle, how much of a step forward do you think it is to take that you then believe that these laws that the government has in which they operate under are to be disregarded?
This is why Tom DeLay got into government. Because he was a pest control guy, and he resented the fact that the EPA was preventing him from using poisons that were dangerous to kids and pets. So is it any wonder that these guys totally disregard the Constitution? This is an extension of the conservative ideology. This is not an aberration. This is what you get with conservative dominance. Because this has been we have just gone through the first period in 40 years where they controlled every facet of government. And we have seen what they have done to it. They have trashed it. They're trashing the Surgeon General, for Christ's sakes. Surgeon General, former Surgeon General Richard Carmona told a congressional panel Tuesday that top Bush administration officials repeatedly tried to weaken or suppress important public health reports. He was ordered to mention President Bush three times on every page of his speeches. This is just astonishing.
Can you say that one more time?
He was ordered to mention President Bush three times on every page of his speeches.
Who told him that?
Apparently, Putin. No, it was Bush, I guess. I mean, this is the type of stuff that we was talking about with the Soviet Union, right? I mean, this is...
Wow. That's like the...
How do you define dictatorship? How do you define that more than that?
The textbooks in Iraq have Saddam Hussein on the back of every single page.
Exactly. This is number six. This is Carmona saying something that should be relatively obvious, but you see under total conservative dominance, so this is what you get, number six.
The problem with this approach is that in public health, as in a democracy, there is nothing worse than ignoring science or marginalizing the voice of science for reasons driven by changing political winds. The job of the Surgeon General is to be the doctor of the nation, not the doctor of a political party.
Can you believe, the administration, the guy wanted to go and attend a Special Olympics to support the Special Olympics, and the Bush administration told him he couldn't go, because apparently the Special Olympics are somehow, they get support from the Kennedys. I'm not kidding. How demented are these people? Honestly, how demented do you have to be? Number's 800-989-1480. I guess I should say at this time that I do take calls from conservatives. We'll take a break. If there's any conservatives out there, please give a call. Because I'm just sort of fascinated by what could arguably be the conservative mind. And I say arguable because, honestly, how do you justify blowing off the Special Olympics because they get money from the Kennedys? 800-989-1480, Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy and Nova M Radio, 800-989-1480. Coming up in the next segment, Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor, author of United States v. George W. Bush, and Robert Boris, writer and director of the film adaptation of the same book, will be talking to us about the book, about the charges she lays out against George Bush, specifically about this disaster in Iraq. And she also includes indictments for Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Colin Powell. Colin Powell came out the other day, apparently at, I think it was the Aspen Institute. Rich and famous people gather, apparently, in Aspen to attempt to reform their public image. And Colin Powell said he tried for almost 2.5 hours to convince George Bush not to go into Iraq. Good for him. He really laid it on the line, folks, didn't he? And I suppose he is hoping that that admission or that boast somehow gets him off the hook for lying to the entire world, holding up a bottle of talcum powder and suggesting that somehow there was some threat coming from this little bottle of supposedly anthrax. What incredibly despicable. Let's go to Red in Humboldt County, California. Welcome to the program, Red.
Hey, thank you for having me. I just have a challenge to all of my liberal progressive thinking and anybody who even just has a perception of reality at this point of what's going on. We need to rethink this misperception of what the government is, what our elected officials really are. We've been fed this lie by the major media that they are our leaders. That's crap. They are our servants, not our leaders. The
You're absolutely
Republican
right.
Party has been treating us like their servants more than long enough. And it's time for us to stand up and take our rights and our country back. They are our servants, and they are there to do our bidding. And if they do not do our bidding, we dump them in the trash like the trash that they are, and we get new ones in their place. And if they're not willing to do our bidding, we dump them too. The Democrats had their chance. We elected them. We gave them the power. We begged them to do our bidding. We said, please, please, please listen to us. And instead, they listened to big money and gave George more big money. This hurts everybody, not just the troops, not just their families. It hurts America as a country, our image.
I agree with you, Red.
Our leadership.
Red. Let me just stop you here for a second. I agree with you on this, all right? And the Democrats, I mean, look, the reality of it is that, you know, you can't look at the Democrats as a monolith here. I mean, you have to remember that there's a 1 senator majority. I mean, theoretically, Lieberman, but Lieberman is, of course, useless. I mean, worse than useless in this situation. But you have another half a dozen of Democrats who are not very strong on this issue. And they're doing as much, I suppose, that they could be doing at this point, considering the numbers they have. Now, that I'm not making apologies for them at all. And I think in the context of the war, there's only so much they can do. I mean, just there are things that they could be doing to be messaging better. But they ultimately cannot end this without some serious, legitimate defections from the Republican Party. And you've got basically Hagel. And I don't even know if Hagel is legitimately defecting in terms of the war. He's talking a good game. But he's not pushing it to the extent that he should be. I mean, I don't know why he didn't jump into the race. It was talked that he was going to be a presidential candidate, and he at least, from that vantage point, could have pushed this agenda too cowardly. All right, when we come back, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth De La Vega and Robert Boris. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. Man, we got halfway through the show already. This thing's too short. All right, I'll be right back after this. Back, Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on NOVAM Radio. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program on the phone Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor, writer for ThomasDispatch.com, author of The United States v. George W. Bush et al., and Robert Boris, writer, producer, and director of the film version, U.S. v. Bush, currently, I guess, in pre-pro.
That's
is,
right.
Is what we say in the business. Pre-production. Welcome to both of you. Elizabeth, let's start with you. It's a fascinating book, and the way you've written it is really interesting. It's basically, it's almost written as a play in a way or a script.
Right, it is. The way cases are presented to a grand jury is that the evidence is summarized by agents. So what I did in this situation was I gathered all the evidence just as I would in any case, and so all the facts that are presented in the case are true, and the only thing that's fictional is the fact, number one, that there is a presentation, and number two, that there are these agents. So it's in the form of a transcript, and the reader is in the position of the grand juror, can make his or her decision about the evidence.
And so you're basically drawing on your experience as an assistant U.S. attorney and laying out what the case would be. And specifically, the case is centered around what?
The case is conspiracy to defraud the United States, which is a violation of a specific federal statute in the criminal code. And just really briefly, a conspiracy in the law is just a neutral term. It doesn't mean some crazy decoder ring kind of thing. It's just an agreement to commit a crime. And the crime is fraud in the deceit that led up to the war. And the victims of the fraud, of course, are the public and Congress.
And Robert, let me ask you this. I mean, it's fairly obvious why this would make a good film, but what was it that attracted you specifically to it?
I think for me, it was the fact that I felt I grew up as part of the protest generation. We were very active, and what I loved most about those years was the fact that there was wonderful political theater everywhere I turned. There were great plays, there were great films that were all very politically charged and politically oriented. And what's really bothered me over the last several years, especially during this administration, is that there seems to be a huge absence, a deafening silence from the creative community, the artistic community, in terms of political subjects and political theater. And when I found Elizabeth's remarkable book and the fact that it seemed to me like it was a great chance to return to America's great tradition of political theater, is to try and put this on screen and let it be the kind of thing that I grew up on and the kind of thing that fascinated me and the kind of thing that I think America needs desperately now.
I don't know that during the period of Watergate, let's say, that there was somebody who actually laid out something so comprehensively in terms of theater. I mean, this is pretty serious, straight on stuff, isn't it, Robert?
This is very serious, straight on stuff, and Elizabeth has done a remarkable job. You know, in all of these, there are lots of books that have been coming out. Obviously, there's almost a kind of Watergate industry, which is anti-Bush in a way. There's been everybody seems to have their own agenda, whether it be Clark, whether it be any of Tennant put out his own book. Everybody has their own agenda. But what Elizabeth has done in this remarkable book and this what she's presented in front of a grand jury, a fictional grand jury, is this is the one place under one umbrella where all of the most pertinent information and the incredible facts that she's dug up that's multiply corroborated. It's the one chance to see everything all together and to give a real clear picture of how we were led and defrauded into war, and it is a remarkable case that she presents, and that's what I'm trying to put together on the screen.
Now, Elizabeth, this isn't really an impeachment proceedings. This is basically what, in the event that Congress were to decide that they were going to move forward for impeachment, this would be the basis, theoretically, right?
Right. What I explain in the introduction to the book, actually, I don't really talk about impeachment in the book, but I do explain that based on my experience and viewing all of what we know about the administration's conduct, that the crime they committed is so much worse than crimes that are prosecuted around the country all the time, fraud-type crimes. So I wanted people to understand that while I wasn't saying these people should be indicted, I wanted them to understand the law of fraud, which is something that not everybody does understand, and then to see that based on these facts, there's actually overwhelming evidence that there is a fraud, and certainly this whole presentation could be used almost in its entirety in Congress for an impeachment proceeding. It's all there.
What would you say are the most incriminating pieces of evidence that you've accumulated in your indictment?
Well, there are so many. One of the things about the book is that I actually lay out, even beginning before the conspiracy started, the administration's predisposition to invade Iraq. But some of the key ones would be, for example, when President Bush in September 2002, almost 5 years ago now, came out in front of the entire country and said, we're going to have an open dialogue about this war. Well, at that time, we had already been attacking Iraq for months. He already had done five different versions of a formal war plan, and the final one was already in existence. It was called the hybrid plan. Rumsfeld had authorized and caused to be executed more than 50 airstrikes, likely to kill more than 30 Iraqi civilians. Ones that were likely to kill fewer than that did not even have to be authorized. And then the very next day, we launched the largest number of airstrikes we'd ever launched against Iraq since 1998.
This is presumably 5 months, 6 months before we declare war on Iraq.
Right. This is the time. One of the things I did in preparation for the book was sort of an obsessive-compulsive task, actually, which is that I read every single speech and statement on about five different websites from the administration, the Defense Department, State Department, and the White House and others. And there were, of course, as we know, even kind of intuitively, all these different themes. And one of the themes had to do with the fact that the administration wanted the public to think that we were having this kind of conversation and that there was going to be a discussion with Congress. And that was really important for the administration because the polls showed that if the public thought there was this dialogue, they were much more likely to support the idea of the war. So it was quite a Machiavellian thing, even though it sounds almost innocuous. But
we should say that we know from the Downing Street memos that in July of 2002, as far as the British were concerned, the decision had already been made.
Right, and the evidence that I put forth in the book, I talk about the Downing Street memos quite a bit, actually. But whether you focus the proof on the Downing Street memos, which are important proof in and of themselves, or just look at the evidence of what we know had already happened, including the fact that Bush had moved $700 million in funds from Afghanistan mm-hmm. appropriations to Iraq appropriations in July, right about the same time the Downing Street memos, the one of them came out, or was written, rather, came out much later. But, yes, there's no question, but not only that had the administration decided to go to war, we had already been at war. And so that's one major fraud.
I found those facts very chilling, and that's a couple of things that attracted me instantly to the book and saw the potential of it as a movie. And the other thing that Elizabeth discusses is the fact of the secretly diverted $700 million in funds from Afghanistan that went into the Iraq War, which also precluded closing in on Osama bin Laden. There were elite forces that were removed from Afghanistan and sent to Iraq.
All the Arabic-speaking special ops were moved from Afghanistan to Iraq, and they replaced them with special ops who were expertise in training in Latin America.
Precisely, yeah.
That hurts your ability, apparently, to get around Afghanistan if you're speaking Spanish.
I would think, slightly.
That's my understanding.
And those issues, that this secret war had already begun against Iraq when the world didn't even know about it, I think that was very profound, and it's one of the things that Elizabeth highlights so clearly in her presentation before the grand jury.
There is something about this administration, Robert, that is incredibly they're incredibly expert at creating this fictional narrative and really buying into it. I mean, George Bush today in his press conference was saying the same thing over and over again about it being about Al-Qaeda. And it is quite fascinating that they continue to push this. I mean, it's almost as you're dealing with a competing theater troupe here.
Well, they market an idea and a theory, and they market their case almost better than Hollywood markets movies. They are remarkable in their ability to change the subject to. Just before the Gallup poll, I mean, just the other day, you're right, Bush this morning was extraordinary in repeating the same things. And then what was it, yesterday or the other day, just before the Gallup poll came out, which said that Bush is at the lowest level ever, all of a sudden Michael Chertoff is having stomach problems and we're about to face another attack in the summer.
Yes.
So they changed the subject, they shifted around, they are brilliant at doing that, and it's almost that the marketing is almost more important to them than anything else, and they've been very successful. And the Democrats have not stood their ground And that's one of the things that this book does, is it maybe inspired some of the Democratic Party to finally stand up and say it's time to make a stand.
We're talking to Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor, writer for Thomas Dispatch, and author of United States v. George Bush et al., and Robert Boris, the producer and director of the film version. Elizabeth, at what point did you decide... various people at different times came around to understand that this was that we were being played. Mm-hmm. At what point did you decide to write this book? At what point did you realize? I mean, 2004 is when you were still serving, essentially in the Bush administration, at least in their Department of Justice.
I was an assistant United States attorney in San Jose up until September 2004. So clearly, I could not have written this book and remained an assistant U.S. attorney. For very long, anyway.
My understanding is under this Department of Justice, short of going out there and trumping up charges against Democrats, you can't stay in that position very long either.
Right. It's a precarious position to be in. I wasn't a United States attorney, but even so, writing a book indicting the president would really be frowned upon if you were a federal employee. But in any case, I was aware, even when I was still an assistant U.S. attorney, which was dating back to 2002, actually, that things were starting to sound very fishy. Right about the time that Bush came out and said, this was again in the summer of 2002, the president came out and announced that from that point on, fraud for a CEO would be illegal. Now, that struck me, that was in reference to Enron and the new corporate crime bill, that struck me as very befuddling because fraud had already been illegal. And I was having serious doubts about the veracity of our president. And by the time the fall of 2002 came around and President Bush was saying it's an imminent threat and everybody was saying that, yet at least some articles were coming out, not very many, but the fact that the CIA was saying the only time they would invade us is if they thought they were under attack, it was clear to me that we were being deceived. And I wasn't in a position to write the book until I left, but I was raring to go at that point.
All right, we got to take a break. We're talking to Elizabeth De La Vega, author of The United States v. George W. Bush et al., and Robert Boris, the writer, producer, director of the film version. I'm Sam Cedar, filling in for Mike Malloy. We'll be right back. Back, Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M. Streaming at NovaMradio.com. Number is 800-989-1480. On the phone, we're talking to Elizabeth De La Vega, former federal prosecutor, writer for TomDispatch.com, author of The United States v. George W. Bush et al., and Robert Boris, writer, producer, and director of the, I guess you're in pre-pro, the of the film version.
Exactly.
I say pre-pro because I'm looking... I know you're in casting
we're
right
now.
We're
just about to get into the casting process right now. We're just, getting into it, and it's time for, that's what I thought, why I love the book so much and why I wanted to make sure that we brought Elizabeth's story out to a wider audience and to a global audience in terms of a movie. I think it deserves to be seen around the world.
I just emailed you my headshot. Now, let me ask you this, Elizabeth.
Sam, you sound a lot like an FBI agent. I think you would be terrific as one of the part of the task force that works for Liz Devlin.
Thank you, sir. Believe me, if only, not just to play, to actually do. I would like to be the guy to put the cuffs. I want to be the guy who does the perp walk with all the people who are indicted here. In your book, Elizabeth, you indicted George W. Bush, Richard B. Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald M. Rumsfeld, Colin Powell. Why was it important to I presume this has to do with the notion of a conspiracy,
right.
Because obviously you need multiple players. Why was it important to name these people in your indictment, and why did you not include some of the Republican leadership in the Senate and the House who were certainly privy to this, the notion that this was a fraud?
Right. Well, what I decided to do in putting together the case was to limit it to the people I thought were the main people, and that would be the five that you just mentioned. I wanted people to be able to actually pick up the book and carry it around. I didn't want it to be too heavy. And there was just so much evidence that I just had to draw the line. But you're right. There are many other people, both within the administration and in the Republican leadership as well, who could be involved. And that's the thing about a conspiracy. One of the allegations is that these people conspired with each other and with others, known and unknown. You always put that in the conspiracy charge.
That's
you probably
the,
have never been charged with conspiracy.
Not to my knowledge. That's the unindicted co-conspirators. Is that correct?
Right, right, exactly.
Now, Elizabeth, at this point, what can Congress do? What can our listeners do to, I guess it's really, I mean, the book is what they can do. They can begin to educate people as to what the issue is.
Right, exactly, and that was why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm really excited about the movie, which, by the way, has a website that people can look at and see the trailer. I think Bob has the title of the website, but the thing about this book is that it's done in a very non-argumentative fashion, and so I think it can appeal to a wide audience, and it also makes people able to understand something that people kind of understood intuitively, but people didn't really know what the law is. And the fact of the matter is, under the law, even our elected officials have an obligation, at least under some circumstances, to tell the truth to the American people and to Congress. And I explain that law in the book. So people can definitely read the book, spread the word, and mainly contact their Congress people in whichever way they feel most comfortable. Pony Express, email, letters, because there is a movement clearly that's growing, wanting to hold these people accountable. And I think the more ammunition people have in terms of facts, the better off we're all going to be.
I mean, that's the point of the film, too, isn't it, Robert, is just to make it much more digestible for people and more accessible to people.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I felt was terrific about it, about the book, and also about the concept, which I tried to expand on a little bit in the movie, is that in a grand jury, you have these 23 grand jurors who are allowed to ask questions. And Elizabeth cleverly tries to make them a broad sample of the American public. So you get a nice cross-section of people who are from all sides of the fence and all views of this issue. So it's not just, you know, it's not simply a Bush-bashing kind of movie. It really does, or a book, it really does try to open it up and give different points of view so that it really is a really clear sense of how different people view this issue and how some of them can be changed once the evidence presents itself.
All right, Robert. Well, it's Elizabeth Della Vega. The book is United States v. George W. Bush et al. The site is usvbushmovie.com. Robert Boris, writer, producer, director of the film version, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Number's 800-989-1480. I want to remind you, I do take conservative callers. You don't have to lie to the call screener. We will. We may even bump you to the top of the list. I've been known to do that. I hope you're afraid, folks. I hope you're very, very afraid. Because the head of the Homeland Security has got some indigestion. He has a problem in his stomach. He's feeling that I'm getting the adjutant that tells me that the terrorists are going to attack the homeland.
Is Sam, I understand why you're making fun of him, but I don't understand where that accent comes from.
Well, it's just the homeland. Just, he, I keep hearing these people use a homeland. That's why. That's my homeland. Listen to this. This is Michael Chertoff. You know, we know for a fact. We know for a fact that in the months and the years leading up to the 2004 election, the threat level was raised to I don't even know what the color wheel was. It was like it would raise up the fuchsia or something every time George Bush's poll numbers dropped. I think it was Swopa at Needle Nose who put out a graph that combined those two things. And then when Tom Ridge, sort of classic in this administration, once he leaves the Department of Homeland Security, he admits to USA Today, yeah, there were multiple times we raised the threat levels because the White House wanted me to, and I didn't think it was justified. So how little integrity must you have at that point where you do something like that? You're head of Homeland Security, and you'd basically know that you're just terrifying. You're basically doing the bidding of the terrorists for the sake of the Bush administration. Well, Michael Chertoff, he did away. Do we still have the color-coded thing? Didn't he do away with it? But it's only there in the background. They don't tell anybody what the color is. Just occasionally you find out, like, the airport's at orange. What? So here he is talking to the Chicago Tribune, the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune. This is just astonishing. This is number nine.
All these things give me a kind of a gut feeling that we are in period of not of a, that I have a specific threat, you know, that I have in mind right now, but that we are entering a period of increased vulnerability.
That's right, folks. You're all very vulnerable right now. There was a story out in by ABC. This is on July 10th. So that's what, Tuesday, right? Senior U.S. intelligence officials tell ABC News that new intelligence suggests a small al-Qaeda cell is on its way to the United States or may already be here. The what? Okay, so first of all, we have senior intelligence officials leaking this to ABC. To what end? One can only imagine. I guess presumably now we're all supposed to be looking for this small al-Qaeda cell that may be on the way. It may already be here. I mean, that's giving them the benefit of the doubt.
If you see something, say something.
Right. If you see something, say something. Send out the alert. All brown people must be reported now. So then the ABC report goes on to say the White House has convened an urgent multi-agency meeting for Thursday afternoon to deal with the new threat. So ABC reports this on Tuesday. Presumably they found out about it Tuesday. Maybe they found out about it on Monday. So they convene an urgent meeting 2 days later. What bullcrap. What bullcrap. It's vaguely urgent.
It's exciting for people. People, I think, want to feel like they're involved.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
It's important information. We are getting it.
Listen to Chertoff telling you, this is how you can protect yourselves, folks. Here's Chertoff. This is why he's saying, my gut tells me we're going to get attacked. I got no proof. I'm the chief of Homeland Security. I got no proof. Well, my gut tells me it, but here's number 10.
Chertoff says there is no specific threat, but there is increased vulnerability. And 6 years after 9/11,
hold on, stop
Americans
it for a second.
Are complaining.
Hold on, stop. What? What does increased vulnerability mean? I mean, honestly, what could this possibly mean? How are we more vulnerable now than we were 2 weeks ago or a month ago? And shouldn't he be talking to the president about that? Shouldn't they be doing something about that? All right, play this again.
Chertoff says there is no specific threat, but there is increased vulnerability. And 6 years after 9/11, he fears Americans are complacent. And with the travel season in full swing, Chertoff warned against resisting security measures. Airlines are currently at the second highest terror level, orange.
If the public wants to take that risk, they should take that risk with their eyes open and understand the consequence may very well be that someone will, it'll be easier for someone to come in and kill Americans.
What is he talking about? Who is resisting security measures? Everyone, listen, ladies and gentlemen, you're obviously not shopping enough. You're not trying to defeat the terrorists by shopping enough. Unbelievable. Let's go to the phones. Leon in Miami. Welcome to the program, Leon.
Hi, Sam Cedar. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, sir. Now, listen, something I got to say as quickly as possible, and I want you to know at the outset. I told this to the screener, you know. I've been listening to you a long time, and I like you, you know. And I think you do a very professional job, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, now, I think you're making a big mistake on the way you handle what the American people are facing, okay? Now, here's what. What we're facing, all right, is not primarily a political problem, you know. Although anything could be expressed as a political problem, you know, I could say I have a political problem every time I go out in the street and blah, 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 and so on and so forth, but that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm saying what we primarily have is a truth problem, okay? Now, just let me say this quickly, all right? We're suffering from a propaganda system, and I want to give you two key elements in that propaganda system, okay?
Okay.
One is what happened on 9/11,
mm-hmm.
okay? Which I think you the word you're using, you're on the right track, but now you need to apply it. The official story is bullcrap, okay?
Right.
People know the websites they can go to. Most of them, they know 9/11 Truth and so on. I want to get on one other website because I want to get to the second point.
All right. Let's get to the second point.
The second point of bullcrap, okay?
Yes.
And I want you to know, again, I'm with you.
Leon, I don't need a qualification.
Here I go.
Just let's hear
it. You got it. Okay. Here it is.
Yes, sir.
This is the biggest bullcrap that there is Al-Qaeda organization. There is no Al-Qaeda organization. Now, listen. Don't get excited.
I'm perfectly calm.
Al-Qaeda. Huh? Now, let me finish. Let me finish. Because
yes,
it's important.
Leon. Yes.
Every time you hear that, you hear the big lie. Okay? Every time. You with me?
Yeah, Leon.
Listen, I'm talking to everybody now.
Yes.
Every time you hear a report about some kind of group that's caught doing this or that, you're always going to hear there was an, if you check the facts, remember, we always check the facts in the 60s, and that we got to keep it now, that's what you need for the truth.
All right,
Every time you hear it, you're going to hear there was an FBI informant that entrapped some people into something that
all
the
right,
news
Leon,
media
Leon,
blows
Leon.
Up now.
Now, Leon, hold on for 1 second, okay? Let me just say this. To the extent, I think to a certain extent, you're right. We have a massive truth problem in this country. We have a problem with the corporate media. We have a problem with our politicians. I agree with you that the official story about what happened on 9/11 is a joke. I don't think we're close to knowing what the truth is that happened on that day or what led up to that day. I do believe that they're, I mean, I think to a certain extent you're right that Al-Qaeda is certainly been made into this sort of massive boogeyman, this catch-all phrase that might as well just be evildoers. There is a loose confederation that Osama bin Laden and a couple of those other people are running out of Pakistan right now. And then there's basically, along the spectrum of nationalists, terrorists, there's terrorist groups, or some people in certain instances may refer to them as freedom fighters. I don't necessarily think so. And fundamentalist groups who all now congeal under this umbrella because George Bush and the media and the Republicans, we have all invested this huge meaning into the concept of Al-Qaeda. And so, of course, these jokers in Iraq, and that's what they're jokers. 5% of these foreign fighters who are jihadists, who are trying to drive us out of a Muslim country. I'm not even talking about the nationalists. I'm not talking about the Sunni insurgency or the Shiite militias. Talking about 5% jihadists, and this is a figure that has been brought to us by the Saudi Arabians, by the Israelis, by the British, and by our own intelligence agencies. And they simply adopted the name Al-Qaeda because It sells. They're borrowing the cachet, the prestige that George Bush has invested in these people. George Bush has not weakened this Al-Qaeda. He has grown it in every way possible. He has created this martyr. And in fact, this isn't by accident. He has created this because they needed a boogeyman. There is no red menace anymore. And they were floundering around for a long time. Was it going to be the Chinese? Ultimately, these neocons, I think, really do have a stiff one for the Chinese. But Al-Qaeda, the Islamo-crypto-fascist, whatever the term they're using, that just sells better. That's just the boogeyman, you know, Freddy Krueger, whatever it is that they can say will scare you. They haven't done this by mistake. This is not, it's not a bug, as they say. This is a feature. This is what the software was designed to do. And they have done very well with it. 800-989-1480. We'll be right back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. 22 past the hour. Let's go to the phones. John in Phoenix. How are you, John?
Hey, Sam. Fantastic to talk to you. I got to ask you before I get to my point. You don't believe that last guy, what he's talking about is 9/11 being an inside job, controlled demolition for Building 7. It was a missile that hit the Pentagon. You don't believe that, do you?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's fair for you to put that in his in what he was saying. I mean,
that's
I don't
what 9/11 Truth Movement says. Go to their website, and they say it on this station all the time. You don't believe a missile hit the Pentagon, do you?
No, I don't believe a missile hit the Pentagon, and I don't
believe
that it was.
Building 7 was a controlled demolition.
You know, I don't know about Building 7. I certainly don't think the Twin Towers were a controlled demolition. I'll tell you why I'm skeptical about Building Number 7, and I don't think this proves anything. I think you know that Rudy Giuliani, despite the advice of every one of his advisors, put the control and command center in New York City. This is following the 93 attack.
That's got nothing to do with my question.
Well, no, no, it does.
John,
I'm answering.
We have to get this straight, though, Sam.
John, excuse me. It have everything to do with your question. The command and control center for New York City for both the police department and the fire department was put on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center's number 7.
Right.
It was put in that building because that floor had never been rented. And Larry Silverstein was a big campaign contributor to Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani insisted on putting it there despite all of his advisors telling him to put it in Brooklyn. And the reason why so many firefighters died in 9/11 was because there was no ability for the police department and the fire department to communicate with each other because the command and control center was not operable. They had $500 million worth of gold in there, and they had something like 30 tons of diesel fuel. So it's quite possible they brought down World Trade Center number 7. But I don't read into that any of the other theories around that. But I definitely believe that we do not know the real story about 9/11.
Okay, but my question to you is a simple one.
Yes.
And you're a smart guy. I've heard you before.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
These people spread rumors that it was a missile that hit the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
and that it was a controlled demolition and an inside job that brought down the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you think of the mentality of people who know the evidence and spread garbage like that? What is your opinion of somebody who would say that?
You know what? I think there's a lot of people out there who are frustrated that we don't know the truth. Because, John, you'd have to agree that we don't really know the real story,
Sam,
don't you?
Sam, that's a non-answer. We do know. I'm asking you if you do know what didn't happen.
Well,
you know,
I don't. I'm going to tell you explicitly, John. I do not believe a missile hit the Pentagon.
Right.
I do not believe that there was a controlled demolition of the Twin Towers.
Right.
I don't know what else you want me to... What is your point, John?
my point is that you people on the left, but not you, because you just admitted that those people have to be mental patients to say that.
No, I didn't say anything like that. I said exactly the opposite.
I said
we do not know the truth, John, and you've agreed with me that. And
man,
so what happens? There's a vacuum that's created. All right, John.
I know exactly what the truth is.
John, go to your next point, buddy.
Look, we haven't even gotten over this. My point was is that
John.
The craziness on the left that you hear on the radio is, and this is typical of them. That's
John, listen, you know what? You're on left radio right now, and so far, you're the craziest guy I've talked to all night.
Yeah.
You're a lunatic. Man, John. You know, I'll tell you something. It's so pathetic. I give this guy an opportunity to say his piece on national radio, and he makes an ass out of himself. I got to admit, though, it's fun. 800-989-1480. If there's any more conservative callers who wants to call, I mean, I don't know if he was conservative. I don't know what his point was. He wasted all of our time. Although, you know, Lauren's laughing. She enjoyed it.
That was pretty fun.
That guy was very frustrated that I would not play along with his stupid game.
Why would he complain? I mean, he's on the radio.
We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for the great Mike Malloy. Novam Radio. Number's 800-989-1480. I still can't get over that last caller. There's something fundamentally, mentally wrong with some of these right-wingers.
Well, he's just like, why won't you put me on the radio? Why won't you listen to me?
And meanwhile, he's on the radio and I'm listening to him.
Exactly.
Very sad. No, there are some explanations of what happened on 9/11 that I do not buy into, but I certainly do not believe that we know what legitimately happened on 9/11. I mean, I believe that two planes hit the towers, and that's what brought them down. That apparently in some circles is a controversial view. The question is, how did those people get in the position to do it? What were they doing in this country? What relationships did they have with people who had relationships? I mean, we got to remember, it wasn't that long ago that we were funding Osama bin Laden. And by we, I mean our CIA. So it's not that big of a leap that there's still some type of nexus between people that the CIA used and bin Laden used. I mean, it's not like that one guy went over there, you know, hey, it's me, Bob. Here's the money. And that was their only contact. And once he retired, there was no other contacts. And it's also not like the CIA doesn't have a history of drug running. And it's not like if you're a terrorist in the number one heroin producing country in the world, you're not going to be looking towards heroin maybe to raise your money. And it is quite odd that there were all sorts of training exercises that day for a situation not unlike what exactly happened on September 11th. That's quite a coincidence. But no, I don't believe that the planes were radio controlled. I think it would have been very simple to hire people just to fly the planes into the buildings. I'm not saying that's what happened. It's just a much simpler explanation. But one thing that is indisputable is that the modern day conservative movement, the Republican Party, needs this boogeyman that they've created. They relish 9/11. They bathe in it. It is like oxygen to this party. And I'm not just saying this. This is a story I read, I guess now, over a month ago. And I'll repeat it here. This is from the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. That's just the name of the paper. So the conservative callers that want to call me at 800-989-1480, you can look up and see if this guy actually said it. The new chairman of the Republican Party in Arkansas, Dennis Milligan. This is what he said. At the end of the day, I believe fully the president is doing the right thing. And I think all we need is some attacks on American soil like we had on September 11th, 2001. And the naysayers will come around very quickly to appreciate not only the commitment for President Bush, but the sacrifice that has been made by men and women to protect this country. This guy is begging for another attack. So, I mean, first of all, the logic is, of course, demented. If we get attacked again, people are going to appreciate all the work President Bush has done to keep us from being attacked. But then this desire that, like, nobody's going to appreciate the Republican Party and what we're doing unless we get attacked again. That's what really needs to happen. And it's not just him. You remember Rick Santorum. Man on dog Rick, who at one point was one of the leading Republican candidates for 08. And now he's working at some crazy, bat crap crazy America enemy. What is the name of the place he's working at?
I wouldn't say bat crap crazy. It's part of the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. What's the name of the program he runs?
It's called America's Enemies.
Ah, yes, the ethics, right. Mm-hmm.
That will focus on identifying, studying, and heightening awareness of the threats posed to America and the West from anti-Western forces, blah, 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 shadow, casting a shadow over our future, dark force.
Why does he say this is important? This is exactly what I've been saying. Rick Santorum and I are going to agree wholeheartedly here on one thing.
Well, in these perilous and uncertain times, said Mr. Santorum, I believe it is critical that we define the threats that confront America. Without a clear definition and precise understanding of our enemies, we cannot fight effectively, and our own citizens become divided.
That's it right there. We must define a threat so that we are all unified under their president. You know who says something like that too? Or exercises the Fidel Castro. Kim Jong-il. This is what they do. Osama bin Laden. Define the enemy, and that's what we can all rally against. Well, here's Rick Santorum on that lunatic Hugh Hewitt's show. Hugh Hewitt apparently was the first curator of the Nixon Museum, which has been universally considered a total joke. They have one small room involving Watergate. Like, the closet is the Watergate story. And it's all just sort of basically blames the media. Rick Santorum said on this Hugh Hewitt show, between now and November, he's talking about the morons running for president in the Republic, Giuliani, Romney, and Hollywood Fred Thompson. They understand the importance of the national security of this country. They also understand that between now and November, a lot of things are going to happen. And I believe that by this time next year, the American public's going to have a very different view of this war. And it will be because, I think, of some unfortunate events that, like we're seeing unfold in the UK. Now, I don't know if he was on his knees praying for this country to be attacked again. But frankly, I don't think people are going to fall for it again. I don't think an attack helps these lunatics. Because we have been following their program now for 6 years. And Osama bin Laden, according to our own intelligence agencies, as reported in the National Intelligence Estimate released this week, is now at its highest ebb since 2001, September 11th. It is now at its strongest that it's ever been since September 11th, 2001, according to our national intelligence estimates.
Thanks, guys.
Well done. And that doesn't even include all the Al-Qaeda franchises around the world who now have something to rally around.
The copycat crimes, as I like to call them.
Exactly. No wonder why Chertoff has got a gut feeling. My gosh. These people are unbelievable. Let's go to Dave on in San Francisco on the Quake. Welcome to the program, David.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
Oh, great. You know, we missed you on the Quake, Sam.
The Quake.
Hey, listen, the week of the 4th of July, there was a lot of talk about the presidential directive number 51.
Yeah.
And then with this Chertov announcement yesterday, I don't want to sound paranoid, but I just thought maybe you could address that a little bit.
Well, this Directive 50, I think it's 51,
right.
Says that essentially it basically talks about what happens if we're attacked and secession powers and et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is, I think Josh Marshall on Talking Points Memo wrote about this. It's not as extreme as it sounds, A. It does sound pretty extreme,
like,
but apparently...
Like take over, you know.
But, you know, here's the thing. That type of situation scares me a lot less than what happens every day with this administration. Because in a situation like that, that is basically put up or shut up time. That is when people in our military begin to say, hey, wait a second. This is too acute of a situation. This is too out in the open. If George Bush gets out in front of the television tomorrow and says, I'm taking over. You know, when Giuliani, people forget when we were struck in New York on 9/11, Giuliani was on the day of the election. Giuliani didn't say, we're going to put the election 3 weeks from now, or we're going to put the election 2 months from now. He said, I should serve another term. And people were like, you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
Even America's mayor. And if George Bush pulled that, I think that's the best thing that could happen to this country.
Yeah.
The real problem is, on a daily basis, people do not see what he is doing to our government. They do not see what is coming down the pike in terms of an attack on Iran as an attempt to...
What the directive is for people who may not know what it is?
To be honest with you, I don't know the specifics, but it basically says that he can control any type of... The really scary part for people is that even under a circumstance of, let's say, a Katrina, a not necessarily a national emergency or one that is localized in terms of how many people die, he can basically exert all sort of emergency powers. And the fact of the matter is, if you attempted to do something that in like a Katrina situation or even in a situation where a city was attacked, I just don't think the rest of the country would stand for it. And I think it would wake people up more than anything else, frankly. So I'm not as concerned about that. I'm far more concerned with what goes on a daily basis, which allows people to not really pay that much of attention to it. But, you know, hey, listen, what do you call it? American Idol's on. You know, who cares that Harriet Myers doesn't show up to testify and basically gives the finger to Congress? Who cares that the Department of Justice is basically saying that Congress has no right whatsoever, no right whatsoever to call these people in, that there's this blanket notion of executive privilege? I mean, that to me is far more dangerous, and people just don't pay attention to it, and that's what makes it far more dangerous. Bob in Santa Clara, California, welcome to the program, Bob.
Sam, it's an incredible throwback. It's a flashback to 04 with you and Janine. I'm just sitting here relishing it. Loving it. And,
Janine, I can promise you Janine's somewhere listening to her radio arguing with me.
Arguing with herself. No, I'm kidding. Sam, you're a very bright guy. I've been listening to you since the very first day of Air America. I think it was around April Fool's Day, 04.
Yes.
And I got to get your take on where you think the Sanchez committee or the subcommittee, where do you think, what is the ultimate outcome of this kind of flagrant middle finger contempt for our Congress by his former appointees? What's going to happen here?
Well, I mean, I think the first step is going to be that they're going to try and go through the most benign process, which is basically task the Department of Justice. It's the U.S. attorney in the Washington, D.C. district to basically hold her in contempt. And I think at that point, the guy's going to say, no, we're not doing it. And then, to be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, the options are that they use their inherent contempt power, which basically says that they send the sergeant of arms to go get Harriet Myers. They put her in some type of room in Congress. I mean, literally, this is what it is. It hasn't been done since 1935.
The inherent, in quotes, inherent contempt clause, I think is what you're referring to.
Exactly.
The postmaster general in 34 or something was taken down that way.
Exactly. And they bring this person into Congress, and they basically have the trial in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And if they find her guilty, then they basically hold on to her until either she, starts to talk or Congress leaves session, I believe. The other way they could do it is maybe attempt to appoint a special prosecutor, or they can go into a civil court and sue for a sort of declarative type of judgment, which would establish whether or not executive privilege holds in that situation. I don't know what they're going to do. I think it's critical that they pursue this aggressively.
Deeply serious. I just read that they flaked out on Ben Nelson of Nebraska, flaked out in the ultimate vote to defund Mr. Cheney's office, by the way.
Yeah, they attempted to do that based, I think it passed committee, but I don't think they're going to have him in the Senate to basically defund him. I mean, why would you fund him as part of the executive branch if, as he claims, he is neither fish nor fowl? He is not part of the executive branch because he's part of the Senate. He's not part of the Senate because he's part of the executive branch. I'm my own guy. All right, we've got to take a break. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. Toast. Not only, apparently it's come out now that he has $250,000 left in his campaign. Half of his campaign staff quit. His top three campaign staffers quit. Now there's a story in the New York Times. On top of all this, he freaked out in the middle of the Senate session on Tuesday. At about 3 p.m., McCain ducked off the Senate floor, entered a Republican cloakroom, took out his mobile phone, made a conference call to fundraisers, which apparently is illegal. And for a guy who 10 years ago led the Republican calls for an independent prosecutor to investigate accusations of violations of the same exact rules by Vice President Al Gore, McCain is toast. And frankly, for all his violent cheerleading of this war. And he was one of the original neocons. There's a reason why Bill Kristol wanted him over George Bush, because he didn't think Bush was actually on board with the program. Never underestimate the ability of a dry drunk to be completely manipulated by a sociopath like Dick Cheney. That would be my words to Bill Kristol. So John McCain deserves a lot worse for everything he's done, but I'm glad his aspirations and his ambitions have been washed away. I really do appreciate it. John in Trenton, Michigan. Welcome to the air, John.
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah, you there?
Yeah, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
I love our subject, I'll tell you. I like listening to you. Unfortunately, I just get off work, so every night I get off this time, it's kind of late, so I always, I'm lucky if I get through, but I want to talk
Well,
to
I'm
about...
filling in for Mike.
Yeah,
this is Sam.
I know. I remember him talking about you coming in. He said, we'd love you, and he was right. We love you.
Oh, I appreciate it, John.
I mentioned to him before about the website, NASCOcorridor.com. That's about the superhighway coming through the United States.
Yeah.
From Mexico into
yeah.
Canada.
Yeah.
And I found another one this week. It's NorthAmericanUnion.org. Pretty interesting website where Bush, the administration, wants to unite Canada and Mexico with the United States and change our name from United States of America to United North America.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm not terribly concerned that that's going to happen. My concern is that we have this this agreement, NAFTA, that is basically destroying jobs for Americans in this country, destroying jobs for Mexicans in that country, allowing corporations to go over there, basically destroy their environment, exploit their labor. It is a big reason why we're having such an influx of undocumented workers in this country, because our major agricultural companies are allowed to go in there and basically kick Campesinos off there, and our subsidies for things like corn make it impossible for them to make a living in the fields, and so they come up here. I mean, you know, again, it's one of those situations where, you know, at least it would be out in the open. At least it would attract people's attention. I'm not concerned about the loss of our sovereignty, folks, as a nation. Hell, maybe if we actually were all one nation, Mexicans and Canadians, maybe we'd get universal health care, and maybe people would take to the streets a little bit easier. I'm not sure that would be a bad thing. All right. Are we done? Lauren fell asleep about a half an hour ago.
What? I'm sorry.
All right, well, my thanks to Mike and Kathy and Shelly and Anita. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Novan. Thank you, callers. Hope to talk to you again soon. Who knows? What is it Mike says? Watch your back. Talk to you later. Thanks again, Mike.